So I've got a question for all the video game lovers out there. Are you seriously going to miss out on Alienware's biggest gaming sale of the year? I mean, these are Black Friday prices we're talking about, so it's not just another sale. I took a look, and this is some pretty big bang for your buck. You know, it's Alienware, with some of the most advanced engineering out there, with systems at the top of reviewers' lists. And what about a gift for yourself? Gift yourself a new Alienware 16 Area 51 gaming laptop. I mean, this thing's got performance at the absolute next level with Intel Core Ultra processors. And even better, you can get it during Black Friday. Plus, you can save on all kinds of displays and accessories, like the Alienware 27 4K QD OLED gaming monitor for ultimate visual fidelity. These really are incredible deals on PCs with otherworldly performance, so I'd visit alienware.com/deals soon and grab what you can before their biggest sale of the year goes dark.
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
This week in Retronauts, The Fox and Our Stars. Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Retronauts. I am Jeremy Parrish, recording live in Kyoto, Japan, at the offices of Q Games.
Yay.
And this is an episode that has been a year in the making. I'm glad we finally managed to line it up. And this year, we're recording, making the attempt to record before Bit Summit happens rather than after, because events like that take a toll on humans. So, yeah, I am here with two special guests, and I'll let them introduce themselves and talk a little bit about themselves, if you don't mind.
Okay, I'm Dylan, and I run Q Games, and I've made a few games.
Do you want to give your last name, too?
Dylan Cuthbert.
There you go. I mean, I think people probably know, but
yeah, okay.
You know, just in case.
Yeah, just in case, yeah.
And I'm Mark Lentz. I work at Q Games, and I'm also a Retronauts fanboy.
Yes,
sadly.
you're the one who made this happen. So thanks to you, I am here and talking to a man who has worked on many classic games, things that we have talked about on the show before. But it's always great to be able to get insights from, you know, the person who actually created this stuff. Mm. And so, of course, I think your most famous work has been to date Star Fox, just, you know, because of the sort of place that held in game history and Nintendo's history and what it represented for the Super Nintendo system. But I feel like you've probably talked about that a lot over the years, and people have asked you most of the questions that I could think to come up with.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to
have one or two, you know.
I'm not really going to focus that much on Star Fox. I'm more interested in talking about sort of the road that got you to Star Fox. And you know, what that represented for Super NES was kind of built on the shoulders of many other projects you had worked before that. And then, you know, after Star Fox, like, how did you get to the point of, you know, running Q Games and working on the Pixel Junk series? So those are really kind of the two main areas of focus here. Mm. And I know you've got a lot going on for Bit Summit preparations, so I'll try not to keep you too long and drag this out into the night. Also, I'm very jet lagged, so at about the 30-minute mark, I may fall asleep.
We'll just carry on talking.
Right. Just keep going. I'm sure, just to keep the tape rolling, I'm sure it'll be great. And you can, I'll edit out the snoring.
Yeah. It will be painting pictures on his eyelids.
So, Yeah, thanks. Thanks for making time in this, like I said, busy lead up to Bit Summit. I know you're showing Eden Obscura there.
Actually, we're showing another game.
Oh,
called, right. Sticky Bodies.
Okay, I don't even know about
that
one.
Yeah, you see,
we announced.
Well, we kind of leaked it kind of a few days ago, right?
It's okay to talk about it because this will go up in a few weeks. So.
Yeah, yeah. No. It's we've put a picture up about it.
Okay.
But we haven't released any more information about it.
All right. So what is Sticky Bodies, aside from something you want to avoid on the train?
It's yes, exactly. It's it's a result of a game jam we did earlier in the year, and the idea was kind of interesting. So we thought, oh well, let's just expand it out and see what the Bit Summit people will think of it. You know, the bits people who come to Bit Summit, and it's a game where you drop strange humans or people from the top of the screen, and they fall and fall and fall, and they collect with other humans and things. And at the end, there's a surprise waiting. And that's what I'm going to say.
Okay.
So, and I made the music, just throwing that out.
Oh, yes,
there.
Yes, that's true. Yeah,
that
yeah.
is what you do here, apparently.
Yeah, amongst other, a lot of things, right? A lot of things, yeah.
So what is the objective with Sticky Bodies?
To collect pork pies and sausages on the way down while trying to get as many of these sticky bodies to stick together as much as possible.
Okay.
And then you get scored on it at the end. It's an iPhone game, so it's just a little quick little thing.
Okay, yeah. So just like a little...
Just a little fun little thing, like a little Angry Birds. Not Angry Birds, more like Flappy Birds.
Got it. Like, so kind of in the spirit of like Stunt Copter or something.
Yeah, yeah, it's kind of that kind of thing.
All right.
And just a very silly, stupid, funny kind of thing. It has all a bit of a sort of Monty Python kind of feel to it, the humor at least. Mm-hmm.
Well, I will look forward to seeing that. So, you said that was a game jam concept?
Yeah, basically, yeah.
So someone here at the studio came up with that.
Yeah, and it's like a combination of someone at the studio, and also we collaborated with the Kyoto, there's like a education kind of group that tries to help students like learn to do, to make games and do stuff like that. And there was they did like a special game jam, and we helped like sponsor it. And then, so it was the idea was like, you know, you have a student and then you give them like a professional person to work with and then see what the two of them come up with. And the two of them came up with this. So.
Okay. So do you feel that just out of curiosity, the way games have kind of, let me think of how to phrase this. So this is a game that's like a small team, basically.
Oh, yeah, it's tiny. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And it's just, we don't know if we'll even make it to completion.
Right.
So it's just for Bit Summit, really, at the time, for the time being, at least.
Okay, so yeah, like I'm curious about sort of your perspective, like historical perspective on this. I feel like gaming's kind of come full circle because when you started out, you were making games as like just a couple of people,
or just one person,
and games then got bigger and bigger and more demanding, and then now we're back where you could make a little game like Sticky Bodies with just one or two people.
Yeah, I think the reason for that is that the audience is like really big now, which means that you can do like smaller scope games, just like games like they were back in like the 80s and early 90s. And because the audience is just so vast now, it means that if you're lucky, of course, you can find people who do enjoy that style of game.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a period, say, around the end of the 90s, perhaps, in the early 2000s, where the number of people playing games was still quite low. And it was like a core group, and they'd only want one type of game, and it had to be like the latest, like technology or the latest 3D or whatever. And so you couldn't really do much variation on that. And there was like another market forming at the time, which was like the sort of flash player kind of gaming sort of area of things. And I think that side has also just really grown really into the current kind of sort of 2D, where anything goes, small games are okay. If the concept is interesting, it can still reach people, I think it's a really good sign.
So you're saying because the gaming audience, the number of people who play video games now is so big, there's more latitude to be able to just kind of jump off and do something weird and still have a good chance of, rolling up some sticky bodies. As
yeah, exactly. The audience is a lot more varied now, I think, as well.
Right. So how does that compare to when you were making games in the 80s as just one or two people on a team? Because obviously the market wasn't big back then. It was more like you had to be a small team because of necessity. That was just what the market would bear.
Well, back then, there weren't so many games.
Mm-hmm.
So it was kind of a balance. So obviously the market wasn't as large, but it was a very hungry market. So you had, like really in the early days, like with the 8-bit computers and ZX81 and ZX Spectrum, that kind of thing, you had a very hungry market for games, and there weren't that many games available. Like, you know, even if you see like a big compendium list, there aren't that many. But each one is actually very diverse.
Mm-hmm.
So back in like the 8-bit days, in the ZX Spectrum kind of days, every single game would be very different to the other games. There weren't many. There were only a few cloned genres really within the gaming side of things. I mean, you had things like ranging from games like Southern Bell, which is like a 3D train simulator, to games, you know, like copies of something like Marble Madness or something like that. But, you know, isometric games. And people experimented with lots of different forms of games and different, you know, be like 3D, 2D, isometric. Some games were like, you know, playing with colors, and it's just a whole range of different types of things.
Mm-hmm.
But the actual total number of the games was quite low still. And so you could still reach people, like enough people to, you know, I didn't actually make any professional games in that period, but I know a lot of people did, and they would reach, you know, easily enough people to make their money back, or you know, to pay them, I suppose.
Yeah, the impression that I've gotten, just, you know, not having experienced the Spectrum market myself back in the day, but the impression that I've gotten from reading retrospectives and things like Retro Gamer magazine is that the Spectrum market was actually, and just the 8-bit computer market, especially in the UK, was very sort of freewheeling, and there were, you know, from my perspective, a lot of games being created by small amateur studios because the barrier to entry was so low. And you had, you know, if you could do some fairly simple programming, relatively simple programming, and get a game onto a cassette tape, then you could sell it for, you know, £3 and get it out there. So I feel like the line between pro and amateur development was very, very thin. And in a way, it kind of feels like, I don't know, to my mind, sort of like a rough draft for what we have now.
Yeah, basically, yes. So it's like very similar to that kind of feeling where basically everybody was making games like in their bedrooms or whatever, and everybody was like indie, basically. And the publishers, you know, there were a few publishers, but they were really just kind of distribution companies, really, in effect. You know, they would deal with the printing and the getting the game into the shops and that kind of thing, and not kind of the sort of top heavy kind of publisher kind of thing you have now. And I think it is similar to the sort of the indie side of things you have now. So actually, like, for example, BitSummit is very similar to the old gaming shows, like in the 80s and 90s, where it would be people who have made their own games, and they've just, you know, rented a very, you know, a table, and they're selling the games on the table, you know, and showing and letting people play them on the table. It's very similar to that. So it is actually a kind of a throwback to that old kind of classic time.
Right.
Which is a lot more fun. So, you know, I think that's why people like being indie as well, because it is actually more kind of fun and more like how it used to be.
Yeah, I have been to BitSummit once last year, and it was very gratifying to just walk around the show floor, and the variety of people showing games was really impressive, because, you know, indie developers who have never made a game before and are like, please look at my game, and then you have people who have a lot of experience, like Mr. Kimura, you know, was showing off Million Onion Hotel last year, and I know he's got a new game this year.
Yeah.
And, like, he's a very seasoned developer. He's been around since 80s, 90s, but you have, you know, like, there's not really a line, a hard demarcation there, and everyone is just kind of out there waiting to meet people and, you know, just show them what they're working on and see their reactions.
Yeah, exactly. And that's really kind of what it was like back in the day as well. So the parallels are definitely there. And I think the I think in general it was just it's just a lot more exciting to be that way, to be like that, you know. Like if you go to the Tokyo Game Show or E3 or somewhere like that, you end up seeing a lot of very like a lot of marketing, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, you just see the publishers, you don't see the people who are actually making the games, and it's all very slick and polished, and you know, very much a public relation experience kind of thing. But at Bit Summit, you get this kind of very raw. You know, the people are just right there, sitting there, and they want you to play their game. You know, it's not just someone who only played the game yesterday, you know, showing off the game. It's actually the people who made it showing it off. It's great.
So you said, you know, that's the fun of it, the thing that's exciting. So is that what got you into making games in the first place? Like, how did you fall into this? Is there just something about the creative process you love, or the like the sharing of it? I'm like, what really motivates you?
Yeah, I think at the beginning, I think this is my theory, at least for children, is that children always try to find. Or they try to find a skill that their parents don't have and then try to excel at that skill. So, for example, like my son would be started learning the piano, and I can help him a little bit with the piano, but then he's realized that he can actually be a lot better than me at the piano, and it just kind of it encourages him to... It's like almost like a rivalry with your parents. And so, you know, when I grew up in the... It was like the 70s, I suppose, late 70s, my parents were very untechnical, you know, and didn't know their way around computers and stuff. And then I realized I could, like, kind of show off my skills of just the few things I'd learned from, like, magazines and typing in programs. And I thought, oh, I can do that. And kind of, like not show them up, but I can actually excel in this. And it's my own skill, you know, that I can learn myself. And I found that, and of course, obviously, at the time, it was very cutting edge. So a lot of people, you know, games were very new and very exciting for kids especially. You know, you always wanted to go to, the local fish and chip shop where they have, like, the one, like, lone unit of, what would it have been back then? Like, you know, like Space Invaders or Pac-Man or something like that. So it was always very interesting. But the, you know, how do you make a copy of that? Like, how do you get to the point where you can make something that looks like that arcade game at home? And, you know, you had these little 8-bit machines, and my friend got a ZX Spectrum, like, from his uncle, I think, and I just go around to his house, like, every night, and we'd just be typing and programming these things to see what we could get up on the screen and stuff like that. And slowly through that process, you know, I learned how to program and how computers work, and found that I could learn a skill here that not many people or not my friends didn't really have, and it just kind of felt exciting, you know, sort of cutting edge, and I kind of got hooked to that process of, like, trying to get stuff looking interesting. So back when I started, I suppose you could say there weren't really any computer shows or anything like that. It was really just magazines, really. Mm-hmm. You know, looking at magazines, typing in stuff, just trying to get something appearing on the screen and just enjoying the process of a very limited, you know, 8-bit computer.
Was there any motivation there to get your game into other people's hands, or was it really just the thrill of saying, I did this, I made things move on a computer screen and you can control it?
I think as a young kid, I think I did always want to get something that I'd made onto, like, you know, a cassette tape with the packaging. And back then, you know, the packaging and the inlays, you know, of the games were so well made, you know, surprisingly good quality. And the art, you know, sort of artwork on the boxes is always really nice. And yeah, so I really wanted, it probably wasn't immediate, but like after like maybe a year of just playing around on these things, because initially, you know, in those days, it wasn't like a console. So there weren't, when you got one of these things, you didn't really get any games with it. And so you just had to make the games yourselves, and you didn't really think about buying games. And it took like a, maybe like a year of like just typing in programs and doing stuff that way to realize that, oh, I can go to a shop and spend some pocket money and get, you know, like a professionally made game. So it took a little while to see that. And then once you saw that kind of that kind of thing, and you started reading in the magazines where it is only just like one guy making it, or you see the interviews and read, and you think, oh, well, actually, I could probably do something like this. And I, you know, you start thinking about how you want to maybe make your own like game studio or whatever. And by the age of probably 13, maybe even younger than that, I was already sketching like logos and stuff. So I was thinking, oh, I want to make a game studio. I can program. You know, I can make these little games, and I hadn't made any that were professionally sold at that point, but I felt like I really wanted to get into that. And so I started thinking about, you know, branding and stuff like that for my company, you know, company in quotes.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a lot of that's just like the creative thing. You know, when you're a kid, that's where your imagination goes. You kind of imagine being part of this kind of right. community of, you know, game creators that you're reading about in the magazines every day, you know.
You mentioned that, you know, when you look at the Spectrum's library, all the games are different from one another.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming your approach when you were starting to come up with the game concepts was to say, like, what hasn't been done before?
Yeah, yeah.
So how did you, can you talk about some of the ideas that you did come up with and how you arrived at those?
In the early days, I would just try different techniques for, ideas for games, really. I wasn't really, at that point, I wasn't really going for, like, the technical side so much because, well, the Spectrum was quite limited. But, I mean, there were a few technical things you could play with, like little, like, hacking it so you could display graphics in, like, the border around the screen and stuff like that, very simple stuff like that. But the main thing was really just, like, raw game ideas, like, thinking about what you want to do. So I made, like, for example, I made one game which was like it was like a platformer, but there were in the stage there were lots of balls, for example, and the balls would have very crappy like physics simulation, not really physics, but like just, you know, they would either fall to the left or right. If they fell on another ball, they'd fall to the left or right, and if there was a space there and that kind of thing. And then you had to make your way around the level and knock out blocks and try and get the balls out of the way so you could escape the level, that kind of thing. And so it was kind of fun just trying to do that kind of simulation. And one of the first things I did in the early days was copy like something like Pac-Man and just try and clone it, and just made a very, very slow frame rate version of Pac-Man on that was on the ZX81, actually. And then a bit later on, I went into these are all kind of unreleased stuff that I did, of course. And I made a 2D sort of almost like a sort of Turrican style sort of shooting platformer kind of game as well. And that was one of the games that I first took to Argonaut Software when I was like 16, I think, to see if I could get a job. But because it was 2D, I didn't get the job at that point. And then I went back and I had an Amiga, and I thought, well, okay, I'll see if they need 3D. I'll see what I can do. See if I can do 3D on the Amiga. And so I just thought about it myself. And I remember trying to work out how to, for example, rasterize polygons onto the screen. And I remembered from the ZX Spectrum, there was a really good book called The ROM Disassembly. And it had like, it was like a disassembly of the entire ZX Spectrum basic ROM, basically. And I remember in that there was, and it was all annotated. It's all very well commented. So it was telling you what it was doing. I remember in that there was a nice little bit of code that would draw a line, basically, you know, from one point to another with and stepped properly, you know. And at that time, there wasn't really any kind of reference material where you could learn how to do that kind of thing in a neat way. And it's called the I think it's called like the Brezhnev I think it's the Brezhnev algorithm, I think. And I'm going from memory there, but the I thought, well, if I use that, I can probably rasterize the edges. I can work out what the edges of the polygons are, and then I can use the Amiga's Blitter chip to actually draw the polygons and from start point to end point per scan line as I went down. And so I kind of knocked up this crazy sort of 3D system to do this, and I chained all these like Blitter interrupts and all this kind of weird stuff, and kind of just went a bit crazy on it. And at the end of the day, I had this kind of rotating in 3D kind of game logo. It was like a company logo kind of thing that I had rotating on the screen. And I sent that into Argonaut, you know, by post. And about the next day, Jez called me up and said, okay, do you want a job tomorrow? Okay.
So that's a quick interview process.
Yeah. Because they'd already interviewed me,
right.
You know, a few months before. But yeah, it was pretty interesting. So it's definitely worth trying that kind of thing, because sometimes it does get your foot in the door, you know. But I realized that when I was, you know, at that time I was 17, I just turned 17. And I realized when I was doing this 3D stuff on the Amiga, when I went to ask my math teachers at school, I would ask them about the, you know, like, how do I rotate and project these points in 3D? And you know, how do I do this? And they would just kind of look at me blank, and not, because they didn't really know much about computers. So they hadn't really kind of mapped the two together. And I thought, well, okay, this isn't going to be much use to me, because I want to learn more about math with computers. And when I looked around, I saw that the most advanced company at the time, at least, was either Argonaut or there's another company called Realtime. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, okay, if I want to learn more, I should just quit school and join one of these companies and just learn from the people who are actually making, you know, these very advanced technology games, you know.
What did your parents have to say about that plan? Were they all for it?
Yeah, no, it's surprising. I think my mum at least had just given up by that point, because she knew I was... she knew how much I was into programming, and I think she realized, she probably just realized that in the future, this stuff is probably going to be quite big. And, you know, it was me getting in on the ground level, and I was doing stuff that other kids couldn't do, you know, and certainly other adults couldn't do. And so I think she probably saw the potential in that and let me chase that, which was, quite good. I never had any complaints, you know, like people, you know, trying. My parents would never try and stop me sort of doing that kind of thing.
So your focus on creating 3D graphics on systems that really shouldn't have been able to do 3D graphics was pretty much just prompted by that rejection by Argonaut.
Yeah, basically, yeah. I mean, I'd done some 3D stuff very early on the Spectrum, just because there was a... It's quite interesting, on the Spectrum, maybe in 1982... Sinclair actually released a 3D modeling package kind of thing, like in 1982, which is called VU3D. And it was actually like a monochrome, but solid shaded kind of modeling package. I shouldn't say package, but you could make 3D objects in it, and it would render them in shaded, like dotted kind of, you know, like a monochrome kind of style. And it was quite impressive. So I thought, oh, how are they doing this? You know, so I did actually play with it a little bit back then. But then later on, you know, with games like Star Glider and Star Glider 2 on the Amiga, and also F-18 Interceptor on the Amiga, those games really impressed me. And also on the Spectrum, there were two games. There was one called Micronaut 1 and another one called Academy by the same guy, Peter Cook, or Pete Cook, maybe. And they'd always just very, very much impressed me. Like, and I always wanted to try my hand at them. But what the rejection from Argonaut did was kind of trigger that a little bit stronger. I thought, okay, I'm just going to have to do it and by myself. And so I just went ahead and did what I could do and managed to put it off.
So once you started with Argonaut, I'm assuming that was a no-brainer, and you were like, yes, I'm starting tomorrow. Once you started with them, were you immediately basically just put on your own original game concepts and like just told go for it, or were you kind of brought in as, you know, sort of like auxiliary help to help people you know, with their projects?
Initially, they were finishing up probably like the last half or so of Stargrider 2 on the PC, and initially to like warm me up, they assigned me to that, and so I kind of, me and one other programmer, we basically went through and cleaned it up and fixed a ton of things and debugged it and made sure it shipped. And it didn't have any sound, so I also implemented all the sound as well at that point. But and that was not much fun with the PC sound chip at the time. It was like, you know, like a buzzer. I say chip, it wasn't even a chip, so... That's what sound was like on the PC in the I think it was like 89, maybe.
I thought the Amiga had a sound chip, but did it not?
That's the Amiga, right? No, but it's PC.
So that, working on...
And it was, you know, it was kind of fun for a few months. And then what came up was the Konix multi-system, which was like this toilet-shaped console. Have you seen pictures of it?
I have, but for whatever reason, despite your vivid description, it didn't stick with me.
It's like a hoop shape with a steering wheel, like a flight stick, kind of like an aircraft kind of like controller. And you plugged it into the TV and you play games. You could use this nice analog controller. And the company that made it was a company called Konix. And they got famous making like a very nice ergonomic joystick in those days. It's a really interesting design, and they sold like 3 million of these joysticks, I think, maybe even more than that, and made a fortune from it. And this is this Welsh company, from South Wales, I think. And the guy said, "Well, okay, we're going to make a new games machine," and he just came up with this idea, and he got all these ex engineers from Sinclair, who had just gone under, I think. And so he got these engineers all together, and they built this machine with custom chips and stuff, and it was pretty good. It had like a graphics chip and a 12-bit DSP sound chip, and you could do some pretty interesting things with it. And initially, Jez said to me, "Okay, set up a 3D system on this, you know, get polygons rendered, and use this 12-bit DSP chip to do the rasterization for speed." When I was thinking, well, if you use the sound chip for rasterization, how are you going to get any sound out of the thing? But he didn't think about that. But he said, "Oh, just use that to do the rasterization." So I thought, okay, I'll go ahead and try this. And it was quite crazy. I mean, it's a 12-bit chip, very fast, but kind of crazy to program. Mm-hmm. And I kind of did a combination. I used they had like a sort of blitter kind of chip in there, and also this sound chip. And I kind of combined the two together to create this 3D engine. I started doing 3D experiments on it. And then we knocked up like to begin with, we kind of knocked up this bike racing game. And we went to show it at the ECTS show in London at the time. And next to me was like Jeff Minter, and he was working on it as well. And he was making probably some game with llamas or something, but he was there as well.
Tempest with llamas.
Yeah, basically that kind of thing. They had even, it's quite crazy. They had the chairs. It would move as you play the game. So you'd put the Konix on your lap, and then the chair would be like hydraulic, and it would actually move around as you're playing the game. And it's actually pretty amazing. And they had all this stuff at this show. But then suddenly, they reached the end of their budget or something, and they just suddenly stopped. They said, "Oh, we're not making it anymore." And so like, Argonaut was kind of left in the lurch, and I was kind of left in the lurch. And we were, what are we going to do now then? And then about that point, Jez had seen the Game Boy, CES, maybe? Mm. You know, he'd seen that, and he said, "Okay, we're going to make games for that." and you're going to make a 3D engine for that. and so we hacked together like a Game Boy development kit with like a camera pointed at the Game Boy, and then all wires. Like we took a cartridge, I think the Tetris cartridge, and unscrewed it all, and then just connected up wires to the chips and connected them to this circuit board, which one of the guys at Argonaut had kind of just felt like making. Like, they got into circuit printing, and they were printing the circuit boards in this bath full of acid. We were working in a house at the time, and there's this bath full of acid.
This is the weirdest version of Breaking Bad I've ever
seen. Yeah, right, right. And so this is a three-story house in North London, and I was in the top kind of attic room, and there was a ensuite bathroom in the attic room, and the ensuite bathroom was basically a tub of acid where they were printing the circuit boards and etching the circuit boards to do this like very basic like hacked dev kit using like a Tetris cartridge, and it kind of worked. And so I got like a to the point where I could, you know, I could actually program, compile, get code onto the screen within a very quick time, like maybe, you know, 10 or 20 seconds, and you could get this really good working cycle going. And so I started developing a 3D engine on the Game Boy, and it had an awful, you know, the Game Boy screen, and this, you know, where even the graphics chip is pretty basic. It's fun, but it's very basic. I mean, you've got you know, like, I think it was like 40 sprites, but only 10 sprites on a line and stuff, right? Like this. I can't quite remember, but it's like
there's
all
not,
these rules.
There's not actually enough VRAM,
yes,
to display like a unique tile.
Yes, right. Yeah,
on the entire screen. Like, so, I mean, you can't fill the entire screen with unique graphics.
No, exactly. So, I mean, so obviously, you know, I reduced the screen area until I got an area which I could use and still have space.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And so, and then the surrounding, like, you know, the GUI would be using the tiled system. And then I wrote a system which transfers like a bitmap from memory into the character map data, using because you can only transfer in the H bank, which is the gap, the timing wise, and the gaps on either side of the screen when it's taking data. When it's not reading from the memory, is the only time you can write into it. And so there was this one flag you had to like poll, and then you could transfer like 6 bytes or something. I can't remember what it was, but maybe a bit more than that. But it was like you just rushed to transfer as much as you could, and then when the flag cleared again, then you could no longer write to the memory, so you have to stop, and then you wait for the next one, et cetera, et cetera. And by doing this, you could actually transfer just enough data over maybe 2 or 3 frames, I think, to update a bitmap, you know, on the screen. And on top of that, I used that to transfer like a very, you know, simple black and white bitmap. And then I also used each character had like a four gray palette.
Four tone.
And I used data in the background of that to do a light gray horizon. So, you know, so I could have a horizon which was just kind of shifted. It couldn't like rotate around properly because it wasn't proper 3D, but it could be offset, so it looked like it was roughly 3D. And then, and that gave it like an extra level of parallax. And then I had the black, very, you know, the straight black and white 3D graphics on top of that. So I developed that, and it was kind of running quite nicely. And the graphics are wireframe. And Nintendo saw it at the next CS, because there were 2 a year back then. And so at the next CS, sort of Jez went around, showed it to them, and then they were like, showed them that. And also we're doing a NES demo as well. One of the other guys was doing a NES demo. And then they had a very simple kind of Star Glider, not really Star, but they had a few 3D objects moving around in a fairly, yeah, something that looked a bit like Star Glider. And they showed my game, which at the time was called, it went through a few names. I think it was called Eclipse.
Okay.
At the time. And at that time, it was already signed to Mindscape. So Jez was very quick at getting it signed up, you know, because he had an agent even back then. for Argonaut. And the agent, I quickly signed it up for him to Mindscape to get money coming in. And then Nintendo saw it. So one of the, business managers or business development guys at Nintendo saw it, a guy called Tony Harmon saw it. And then he said, okay, no, you've got to go and show this to the Nintendo HQ guys because they'll be, you know, really surprised. And he sent them a ROM of it. And the guy who kind of made the Game Boy, you know, Yokoi-san and also Izu-san, who's like one of the guys who's the engineers, one of the engineers behind it, they saw it. And they, when they first saw it, they were so blown away by it, they asked for us to be flown over to meet them.
Wow.
And then it was probably like 2 weeks later that we flew over. And then that was my first time in Japan.
Mm.
And I was probably 18, I think, at that point. It was just after the summer CES. So, yeah, in probably 1990, maybe, I think. And they flew us over, and it was really hot and humid. Remember that. And I went to the offices, and like just row of like Nintendo people came out. You know, like all in their Nintendo jackets.
Mm-hmm. The work uniforms.
Yeah, and I'd never really been to, you know, like a company like that before, or even, you know, any company in Japan. And suddenly, and really not really met any Japanese people before, even. And suddenly it's just a big row of like maybe 30, maybe 20 or 30, like, you know, Japanese people who came to see the demos. And, you know, amongst them was like, you know, Miyamoto and there's Yokoi and just a whole, you know, group of those kind of people. Yamauchi wasn't in that meeting. He was more just the business level.
Right, like, sure,
He was still pretty, he was already pretty old then, so.
Mm. My understanding was that he was like, games, okay, sure, make them, I don't care.
Yeah, he still made some pretty strong executive decisions.
Oh, yeah,
I agree. It's quite interesting.
I feel like the sort of outsider perspective to the medium gave him a, sort of a dispassionate approach that made, you know, he could just look at it as business.
Exactly, yeah. So, So that's really how I got to Japan first. You know, that then I was here for a week, and Kyoto just kind of blew my mind. I was like, yeah, I want to be here. It's much more interesting than where I am. And also just because the people are so friendly, and it was just, everything was very exciting, you know, like just, there's so much stuff. Like it was such a, an assault on the senses, that it kind of like addicted me to the place. It's like, you know, it's almost like, you know, take like a drug shot or something. It's like whoa, like, you know, this place is kind of really different to you know, what I knew.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, that must have been really interesting, because that was right at the sort of the tail end of the bubble economy, when everything was just like, so great, everything can happen.
Yeah, exactly.
I never got to experience Japan during that era, so it must have been very intoxicating.
Yeah, no, it's pretty crazy, and I didn't really see like any of the more sort of adult pastimes, because I didn't drink at all back then. So, but I still felt the energy, you know, mm-hmm. and also Nintendo are really kind of still fairly small, and everybody's very hungry, kind of, you know, they're very forward thinking, and, you know. And trying to do different things, and still they were still very that very small, hungry kind of company mentality, which is, you know, really good, I think.
Mm. Pluto TV is the leading free streaming television service. Watch more than 100 TV channels and thousands of movies on demand, all completely free. Pluto TV never asks for a credit card. You don't even need to sign up to watch free. Pluto TV is the easy and completely legal way to watch your favorite TV shows and hit movies for free. What are you waiting for? Never pay for TV again by downloading Pluto TV. You can download Pluto TV for free on all of your favorite devices today, including your phone, Roku, Amazon Fire TV, Apple TV, smart TVs, PlayStation, and anywhere else you stream.
If you like Retronauts, you're going to love all the shows on the Collider Network on Podcast One. This YouTube channel is hitting the podcasting scene with everything for your pop culture needs. Check out Collider Sports, Jedi Council, One-on-One with Christian Harloff, Movie Schmodown, Movie Talk, and so much more. Check out the Collider Network every week on Podcast One or wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
My new $4.99 sourdough patty melt combo with two types of melty cheeses is the perfect comfort food for the uncomfortable things in life, like guys named Ronald. There's just something about that name. Try my $4.99 sourdough patty melt combo, only at Jack in the Box. Limited time only. Price and participation may vary. Small fries and small drink.
That week we made they were showing us early prototypes of F-Zero and like Super Mario World and Pilot Swings on this prototype Super Nintendo, which we'd never seen before.
So this was summer 1990.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So the Super Famicom launch was like 4 or 5 months away at that point.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So, and you know, we played a very, very buggy, it was very buggy actually, version of Super Mario World. You know, but and they showed us Pilot Wings, which was the most completed version, completed one of those games, and it's pretty much finished up. And they said, oh, we had to use a DSP chip in this to do like the 3D calculation for the horizon and stuff like that. And we basically looked at it and we said, well, you know, you could probably use like our 3D math know-how to do that without the DSP chip, we were saying. And then Miyamoto said, well, actually, we see this plane. We actually want to rotate this around in any angle, but we can't because we have to draw every frame. And it uses too much VRAM or, you know, too much memory to do this. And we can't really draw every frame. We can't get all the angles we want. And what we really wanted is to render this, you know, using this kind of polygon technology that you guys have, you know, is what, you know, it's kind of what he said. And so we ended up thinking about that for a bit, and then Jez suddenly came up with the idea of, well, why don't we make a 3D, you know, chip on the cartridge that will do this kind of stuff for future games, you know, for the Super Nintendo, and actually push the 3D potential of the Super Nintendo, and it all connects back to the Konix stuff, because when we were doing the Konix stuff, you know, he got friendly with the people who were doing the chips on the Konix, and he knew the number for one of the main chip engineers, who was now out of work because the Konix had just been, you know, a few months earlier had been cancelled. And so he called him up directly from the Nintendo office, from the meeting room. There was a phone in the corner, and he went to grab the, so he went to the phone, he said, I'm going to call, how do I get an international number? And he called directly to England from the corner of the room, you know, with all these Nintendo guys sitting there, right? And and he basically says, so Ben, his name is Ben Cheese, the guy, he passed away, unfortunately. And he said, Ben, so do you think we could make a, you know, do you think you could design a chip to go onto this cartridge? And hold a second, I'll get the pin layout from the guys. And he got the pin layout for the cartridge for the from the Nintendo engineers, and then he listed up all the pins to Ben, and then Ben said, well, okay, yeah, you've got an address bus, and if we put a chip on there, throw some memory in the chip, as you know, on the cartridge as well, we can do it, and then you just transfer it out. And so that was it. That's how he got born. And everybody in the room was like, oh, okay, let's do it. And then Jez obviously went and then presented it to Yamauchi with more detail, I think, you know, like a month later or so, and got it all kickstarted. But it really was just born in that moment.
That's crazy. I didn't realize the FX chip was conceived before the Super Famicom even launched.
Yeah.
That it, you know, basically predated the system itself. Yeah. I mean, obviously the hardware was you know, in production at that point. So it was much too late to change it to add that capability to the hardware. But
that's what they actually tried to do first. They were thinking about it.
Wow.
But of course, they wouldn't be able to make the chip in time. But they were, that was before we knew, because I mean, at that time, at that point, we didn't know when they were thinking of releasing this. Mm-hmm. And it still seemed a bit kind of like in a buggy kind of state. And we thought maybe there was a way to rush it and get a chip on there even quicker than that if we just used like something from, like, say, the Konix directly. You know, if just bring the Blitzer chip from the Konix and put that in there or something. But they didn't have enough time to do that because it's already building up to like final production runs.
Right, right.
And so that's they thought about everything. You know, any kind of any way to get that performance into the Super Nintendo.
So, before we talk too much about the Super FX chip and Star Fox, I want to go back to your Game Boy project, which eventually came out with the name X.
Yes, yeah.
Which I think that works in Japanese, but man, like finding information on that game in English, that title is really hard to work with in Google.
Yeah. that title was decided by Yamauchi.
Okay.
Yeah, so he just suddenly called up Sakamoto-san, who's the director on the game, a month before we finished it, maybe, and just said, "You're calling it X." Like, it was like a really early phone call, he said. Sakamoto-san said, Yamauchi didn't care. It was like 7 a.m. in the morning or something, and he just called Sakamoto directly and just said, "You're calling it X."
Okay, well, I mean, you don't argue with him.
No, exactly. So I met Sakamoto in that week. So
Yoshio Sakamoto.
Yeah, that's when he got assigned to try and help, you know, make this game.
Okay.
With this strange young foreign kid.
Yeah, so I've spent some time, you know, kicking the tires with X, and you know, since it's in Japanese, I haven't made as much progress in it as I'd like, but it's a very, very impressive game.
Yeah.
And knowing that you guys created that by completely reverse engineering the hardware from, you know, like this crazy photographic process with bathtubs full of acid makes it even more impressive. Like companies with development kits that, you know, were kind of nursed along by Nintendo couldn't do stuff like that. Like,
yeah,
I've played a lot of Game Boy games at this point in my chronology of the system, and it's not uncommon to find games by very experienced developers and publishers.
Yeah,
they're like, I don't know how this made it out the door. It's like,
right,
you know, 10 frames a second or something. It's kind of hard to play.
Yeah,
and of course X is, you know, it's pretty choppy, but considering what it's doing with the hardware. Yeah. It's just it's a kind of a technical tour de force.
Yeah, it would have been faster actually, but there was a really annoying problem at the end of the development, which Nintendo have this thing at the end of where they do a test on like all versions of their hardware, and you know when they do revisions, yeah. So they're like, I think there were like 7 or 8 Super Nintendos. And each one is actually a different revision internally. Mm-hmm. And there's like slight changes, you know, with each one. And on the Game Boy, they had the same thing. They had, I don't know, 3 or 4 revisions. And then they were all fine, apart from the very first revision had a bug in the hardware. And the bug was really annoying because it was a feature that it would show up because of a feature or way I was doing things. It comes back to when the transfer of data in the areas at the side of the screen. On the original Game Boy, there was the only 100,000 were sold of the first revision. That's what they said at the time. There was a bug where even if you write in those the H blank sections at the side of the screen, even if you write data in those sections, it would randomly splat somewhere on the screen in the tile map. And I mean just randomly, like splat some data there. And the data was random as well. And so, and this was discovered at the last moment because obviously we didn't have those old Game Boys. And I don't think anyone probably had them at that point anyway, because those original Game Boys had that problem, you know, where the screen would kind of peel off, you know, you had the vertical lines go missing and stuff. And so it was one of those, you know, really early ones, and pretty much everybody had, I doubt there were any users at all of those versions, but they still had to make it work on it. And so what I had to do is I had to write a program that scans the tile map and compares it to a copy that I have in memory now, which I had to create, and then repairs it on the fly for no reason. So, I mean, it's code that is running all the time, even on the new Game Boys and, you know, whatever. That, because I couldn't tell which revision I was on. That, so it just has to run there all the time, and it just slows down the game by another frame. So it's just really annoying, because initially it was all, you know, one frame faster, but I then had to do that to fix this, to kind of patch fix this problem. Which was kind of frustrating.
Yeah, I can see that. So you weren't just writing graphics, you were also copy editing them.
Well, kind of, yeah. So I had to actually, yeah, I had to basically double check all the time whether the graphics are still there. And if I didn't do that, the GUI, you know, the surrounding tiles would just slowly deteriorate and change to random junk.
Right. So you mentioned that Yoshio Sakamoto was brought in as the director of the game. So the game's creative process, how collaborative was that? I mean, were you pretty much there to do the technical stuff and he came up with the design and objectives and everything? Or was it less of a hard demarcation than that?
It was actually, to be honest, the entire game design was mine. And most of it was in place before we actually talked to Nintendo anyway. So, but what Sakamoto-san brought to the table really was the kind of like the fine-tuning and adding touches to make it more user-friendly, I suppose. Like just interesting things like, you know, putting two towers. So there are these bases that you have to dock with. So there are these bases that you have to dock with. And he designed it so there were two towers, like two spires on either side, so you could actually line it up and work out where to go. Little things like that. So.
Okay.
And also just overall kind of gluing things together and that kind of thing. But in general, like the whole game structure, for example, the missions, like a lot of the ideas behind the missions were basically me. And then I suggest these ideas, and then they'd give me feedback on some of the ideas, and then, you know, like a little sort of back and forth, and then we'd, you know, flesh it out and then get the work done and kind of go from there. But it's a kind of it was almost like kind of a one man project in effect, but with like a little bit of like Nintendo touch through it, kind of thing. And I come over to Japan. I came over about 7 or 8 times during the development of that game, and I come over each time for like, I don't know, 6 weeks or 7 weeks, or, you know, live out of a hotel and then go into Nintendo every day and just work.
Right. That seems like the relationship that, you know, like Mr. Tanabe has with Retro Studios and the projects they've worked on, like Metroid Prime and Donkey Kong Country. But was X kind of the trial run for that approach with Nintendo, working with, you know, a Western developer and kind of like saying, go for it and we'll kind of, you know, guide you from above?
I think it goes back to the way Nintendo works anyway. Like they do kind of consider everybody to be a creator, and so they kind of expect everybody to be, you know, creating stuff, you know, coming up with the ideas and making stuff. And that's kind of, you know, how I try to run Q Games as well. So it's not really like a sort of top down kind of approach. It's more a kind of bubble up approach, and then with a lot of feedback going back and forth, and, you know, to get games, to get the ideas kind of refined. And Nintendo's very much like that. So you have like Miyamoto or someone like that, and they're very strong, you know, strong minded. But the actual team itself, you know, are fairly autonomous, and they kind of run and they make the games. And then every now and then, like Miyamoto would come and check the title, like for Star Fox, for example. For X, it would be Yokoi-san, because that was part of R&D 1. But for Star Fox, it was obviously EAD, and that was Miyamoto. And Miyamoto would come in and like check, and then he'd get and he'd obviously try and shape the game and give a lot of feedback. And then sometimes he'd work very directly on one particular feature, for example. So like the player controls, for example. That was really Miyamoto and Giles kind of, for about 2 weeks, Giles had to deal with Miyamoto like hovering above his shoulder, He said he hated it.
I can imagine. I don't like having anyone hover over my shoulder, but especially a known perfectionist.
Yes, declaring. Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's their process. So even on Star Fox as well, even though that was an EAD title and a bigger team, pretty much, you know, almost all the ideas, like all the gameplay ideas in that game, apart from the, yeah, we didn't actually go in and do like layouts and stuff, but like a lot of the movement and ideas and how things work basically came from me and Giles. Mm. And we just, because we brought all that know-how from the British kind of 3D gaming world, you know, like Star Glider, Star Glider 2, and there were a lot of other 3D games back then as well, like Carrier Command, but all these like 3D titles, and we kind of knew the things that work. And then there were, in the gaming arcades, there was a whole other set of 3D titles, like from Namco, stuff like Starblade, and of course back even further back, you know, there's like Star Wars, you know, and we could pull on all those ideas that we kind of knew about, but the Nintendo guys didn't really know at that time, you know, what how to use 3D and how to deal with it and how the camera works. And they have to think about the camera now, because I mean, in a 2D game, you don't really think about the camera at all. And so a lot of the stuff, I mean, we were just going crazy, thinking up stuff, showing it to them, and then they go, oh, okay, we can slap some graphics on that, change it to be this kind of looking thing, and then they just tune it a bit, and then it would work. You know, so it was pretty pretty interesting process, but that was also very autonomous.
Interesting. Heard that X was going to see an English language release under the name Lunar Chase. Do you know anything about that? Like,
yeah, no, we finished that. It was all...
Okay, so it was finished.
Yes, it was completely finished.
We can expect to see that on the Game Boy Mini Classic.
I wish. Yeah. No, it was one of the things that was really disappointing with that, because, you know, it's the first game I made professionally, I suppose, that got to release, and we made the English version, and then Nintendo America felt it was too complicated for the American audience. And at that time, there wasn't a Nintendo Europe to kind of stick up, you know, so right. It would have been okay in Nintendo Europe. If there was a Nintendo Europe, it would have been okay. But at that point there, I think maybe it was Bandai who would distribute Nintendo stuff in Europe at that point. And so it didn't even get to them. But Nintendo America basically said, oh, the game's for our audience right now, who expect something like Tetris, it's too complicated. And you know, there's too much text and, you know, all this kind of thing. And unfortunately it didn't get released. And you know, you think back, and there wasn't really that much like hungriness for 3D in America at that point. Later on, after Star Fox came out, you know, there was a lot more, but
right
back before Star Fox, there wasn't as much, you know, amongst the sort of younger, the Nintendo demographic.
Yeah, X was 92, so, you know, Doom was still like a year away. That was December 93, so...
Oh, right.
So I guess that craze hadn't really caught on, and 3D gaming was still pretty niche over in the US.
Yeah, and even Wolfenstein was PC, so right. It's still not the Nintendo demographic.
Right. Well, I mean, Doom, I think, was you know, kind of transcended the PC, even though it you know, was there. But that was kind of the breakout title. So yeah, I guess I can understand that. But it does seem kind of strange that you had this piece of technology that transcended the hardware, that did something that, you know, you look at it and you're like, how is a Game Boy doing 3D? And that they wouldn't want to put that out just to be like, yeah, you're not going to find this on Game Gear. Like, Lynx can't do this.
Yeah, you know, I was quite disappointed that they wouldn't budge on it, you know. It could be just that back then the shops were quite strong. So, you know, there could have been that they showed the purchases at the shop, and the shops were saying, well, I don't know if we can sell that. And that's it got stopped there. Mm. You know, I don't actually know the backstory very much, but it was all fully localized. Had some really funny English in it as well. So it was, you know, I thought it was pretty, it played really well in English.
Hmm.
Do you have a copy of it?
No.
Wow. Well,
unfortunately. Yeah, I should have kept one. But back then, I mean, it was, we developed on the Amiga. And I can't remember if I put, you know, back then I was so young, I just didn't really think about it, you know, about keeping like a legacy, you know, in that way. I should have.
Right.
So, obviously that was a big letdown, but of course Star Fox made it out in all regions.
Yes, yeah.
So the titles, you know, X, Star Fox, the Super FX chip, are those meant to be connected, or is it just like X seemed cool, so that's what they went with? I'm wondering if there's some sort of branding there, because if I'm not mistaken, the Super FX chip was originally called Mario, right?
I think it says Mario on it as well.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, its code name is
Mario. But it's like a zero instead of an O.
Yeah, the code name is a Mario chip. And it, I think, yeah, the it's IO, isn't it? I think I think it stands for something. I can't remember what it stands for now, but advanced rendering, maybe? I don't know. Advanced rendering and IO chip? I don't know. Something like that. But anyway, I'm not sure. I think the Super FX thing was just pure branding. By probably Nintendo America at first, I should think, but I don't know. We didn't really have much, I know, back and forth with marketing people back then.
Right. So. It does seem like a very American 90s kind of name, as opposed to something from Japan.
Yeah, because they did a massive thing at, was it CES? I think it was CES. They did a massive booth for Star Fox.
I think that's right.
Yeah, with laser renderings and stuff. And
yeah, because E3 wasn't until 95.
So, but I've seen a video of it somewhere, I think on YouTube, and it looked pretty cool. I wish I could have gone, but, you know, I was too busy doing the competition cartridge.
Right.
At that point.
the competition cartridge. I didn't realize you were working on that.
Yeah, I did. I made the competition cartridge as well for Europe.
So, oh, okay.
Yeah. They suddenly came to me after, when I got back and I started working on Star Fox 2, and they said, oh, can you just take a few weeks out and knock up a scoring system and make sure the game only runs for, I think it was like 5 minutes, maybe. I can't remember what the time was, but it's like this set time, and then show the score. And can you make that? And so we made it. And because they made Nintendo UK they kind of made that company at the time they launched Star Fox or Star Wing at the time. And so Nintendo UK was pretty hungry to do new things. And so they set up this competition cartridge, for the UK audience, and that made it sell really well in the UK as well.
I guess it never occurred to me that those competition cartridges had to be created by someone. It wasn't just like, here you go, here's this game. Like the Nintendo World Championship cart had to be developed by someone.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So there, you were the guy who did the,
I did the Star Fox Star one. Fox. Yeah. Yeah. And then went back straight to doing Star Fox 2, basically.
Mm.
But it was interesting. I didn't even know what the cartridge was for, because I wasn't in the UK. There's no internet at the time, so I couldn't really, you know, look up stuff easily.
Right.
I couldn't, you know, just didn't know what was going on back there. And afterwards, I heard about the full extent of how popular it was.
Mm-hmm.
And how, like, a load of people said they played it and tried to win the, I think you got like a flight jacket, I think.
Oh.
Yeah,
that'd be awesome.
Yeah, I wish I'd have got one, but I just made the cartridge. They didn't give me anything.
So, with Star Fox, you mentioned that you and Giles came up with a lot of the concepts for it and drew on previous ideas or you know, things that you had played or seen. So,
yeah.
Were there some non-video game influences in there as well? I feel like the asteroid field is very Star Wars, like down to the triangle rocks. Like there's a scene in Empire Strikes Back where you see like a rock formation just like that.
Well, there was definitely a lot of influence from movies. Mm-hmm. Definitely. And I think that shows through, especially on that kind of asteroid field. I mean, it's kind of thing when you were at that point, you know, in the early 90s and you were making video games, that would be the thing you would always be trying to do, like, you know, copy scenes from Star Wars and stuff like that. And I think, you know, or scenes from like 2001, you know, just those sort of like spacey movies. And And I think there's a lot of that in there. A lot of the influence, though, a lot of the primary influence was probably came a lot from Starblade, and then quite a hefty mix from Starglider as well.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff like having the enemies flash when they hit and stuff, which wasn't that common back then, but especially in the 3D games at the time, was all a very arcadey thing that was in Starblade, and it was kind of fun. And so we thought, well, we should put that in our game for sure, because it just works so well. Little touches like that here and there.
How much of the sort of the personality of the game was Argonaut, and how much of that was Nintendo coming in and saying, we need to give this a little character, like the final boss should be a giant cubic space monkey?
The final boss is one of the things that they came up with primarily because they wanted to tie it into the whole animal theme, which was very late in the day. So it became like, Star Fox probably in the last few months of development, really. Mm. And until then, there wasn't so much emphasis on the sort of animal brigade, the team of animals. And all that sort of messaging stuff went in really in the last 30% of the game, really. Because we started on that iteration where it was like parallel scrolling, going through, tunnels. We started that version around the beginning of the year. So around the beginning of 1992. We had the engine from the previous year, and we were working on something that was a bit more all range, a bit more standard kind of 3D sort of shooting game before that. But we came back from after that new year, and Miyamoto had been up to the Fushimi Inari Shrine in Kyoto, which is the shrine with all the gates that go up into the mountain. Mm-hmm. And every at New Year in Japan, the Japanese go to the shrines, and they, pay their respects or whatever. And he'd gone to that one, which was near his house, and it was near Nintendo. And he, as he was walking through the gates, he got this image of, oh, well, if we flying through this, it would actually be kind of fun in 3D, and it's kind of, it's fixed and it's controllable. Game design is kind of controllable, which he likes. He likes the very controllable kind of game design. And he came back, and we came back like a week after that from England, from taking a vacation, and he said, well, I want to make the game just scroll forward. And we were like, what? Because we assumed 3D was like all range,
right,
all roaming kind of, and it never occurred to us to limit it to just scroll in one direction. And it really surprised us. And at the time, there was a little bit of backlash, when Star Fox came out, there was it'd be like, internet trolling now. There was like this kind of like a lot of comments about like, oh, it only scrolls in one, it's just a scrolling direction. Why doesn't it let you fly everywhere? Mm. There were a lot of comments back then like that. And so when we first heard that, let's make a demo of it. Let's see what it's like. And we re-engineered our systems to do that within a couple of weeks or so. And it worked really well. And we could see, we could get a lot of speed performance out of it, and it'd just be a really good, play on things, and it would just work, in a better, cleaner way, I suppose, and make it a lot easier for us to make the game. And so it became that iteration at that point. And then late summer is about the time when they started bringing in the Fox characters and all the animal characters, and going, oh, this is actually going to be a game about these, anthropomorphic creatures in this, flying spacecraft. And we were like, okay. And that's how they got to the final. So we'd made a lot of the bosses up until that point, but the final boss was not made at that point. And so that they used that to kind of tie it all up and make it all about the animals. And that's kind of what happened, I suppose. And all the other bosses were kind of made by us. We'd just be creating them the willy-nilly. You know, we just go, well, we want to try this out. Okay, I've got a scrolling texture routine, so I want a boss where something scrolls on the front of it, and I want a message on the front. We just make that, and then it would become the boss. I think that was one of the water stages that had that boss. And I was doing this, playing with technology, with connecting joints and things. And I said, well, we can make these into these arms and, you know, make this, like, thing with flailing arms that you can shoot at. And that's, you know, that's how that boss got made. So it's very much using kind of our ideas. The final boss was basically that. They made it into the, you know, the Andorf head, you know, the Andros. Yeah. I think it's Andorf in Japan, right?
Oh, okay. Yeah. I thought you were going to say that Miyamoto was inspired by the Inari Shrine to make foxes like the main character, since I know there's like a fox affiliation, like the Kitsune. With that shrine.
It comes from that.
Okay,
yeah, it was connected. Yeah.
So. But I can definitely see where that shrine would sort of inspire the idea of like a linear path forward, because it is just, you know, these gates receding up the hill and down the hill and back into the woods, and that's where you go. You have like a path, and then it splits off. So you like, I've been there and I've walked that, but it's just another example of how he keeps finding inspiration and just the everyday. Because I never would have thought like this would be a great video game design, but he went there and was like, oh, I've got it. I know how this crazy 3D shooter we're working on is gonna work.
He really pulls most of his ideas from around him. Like, for example, when he made Nintendogs, you know, he just recently bought or looked out, you know, owned a dog. And that's what gave him the inspiration to do it. And he never actually owned a dog until that point, apparently. And that's, you know, so it's all from his immediate things, immediate sort of things that are going on around him, I suppose. So I find that quite inspiring, really. So I kind of try and do the same thing. So I try and get a lot of inspiration from the things I'm seeing, and I try and spread my wings a bit and go to places where I wouldn't normally think about, you know, going to see, or, you know, strange art galleries and stuff like that, just because sometimes you get to see something which you go, oh, that's actually quite interesting, you know, like maybe that could be used in a game somewhere, you know. And quite often I will pull on a lot of all that kind of, I know, sort of cultural information, and I do actually bring a lot of that into the games that I make sometimes. So I mean, I think it does really help, you know, pull as much as you can in from around you.
So where did you pull in the slot machine ending for Star Fox from?
That's another one where I created this scrolling texture routine, and I wanted a few more places to use it. And they had this, you know, this idea for this secret, you know, stage, and I thought, well, let's see what we can do with this scrolling texture routine here, and that's what we came up with. So it's like, let's have a scrolling display and have a gambling, you know, have a casino. You shoot the arm to you know, set it off, and then it gets. I think it's just random. I think it just gets destroyed when it gets 777. And every other time it fires missiles at you. I think it's just really simple like that. It's one of the last bosses I made. The other place I used it was, what's the name of the thing? It's like this spidery kind of boss on the first course. And I used it to like create this effect where fire comes out from the middle of the boss, and then it fires, it converts to sprites, and then the sprites fire up towards the R-Wing. And that was also like trying to show off the scrolling texture routine, which at the time was quite rare. You know, at that time, there's a lot of these little, like, weird little things we take for granted now, but back then, it was quite cool to have that extra little bit of flexibility and you could a little bit of extra technology you could use.
Mm-hmm. So Star Fox is interesting to talk about because it's not just a historic matter now. It's actually current video game events, thanks to the Nintendo unearthing Star Fox 2 and releasing that on the Mini. I know that for a long time you were kind of sitting on like a completed version, like a completed build of the game. Mm. But having had that finally released legitimately into the wild and let people, you know, play the true finished version of that game, how's that experience been, you know, even kind of looking in from the outside as you have been? How's that been for you?
It's been really interesting. Actually, I had the completed version when we were making Star Fox Command. And Nintendo forgot to take it back after we finished Star Fox Command. And then I left it on a shelf, but it was an EEPROM. And so when I went back to it like 5 or 6 years later, it just didn't work. The data had gone, even though it was covered, you know, because, you know, UV will destroy it. But, just enough UV had got through that it wiped it out, which is a real shame. So, and I remember going back to it a couple of years ago to try and play it again, and it just wouldn't boot up. And I was like, oh, no.
Wow.
And so at that point, I thought, oh, well, that's it then. You know, no one's ever going to play this ever again. Last year, it was suddenly announced that they're going to include this, and it was just kind of mind blowing, really. And I thought, oh, that's kind of amazing. You know, they've kept the ROM around for that long, and they've kept their archives, and it was fully, you know, QA'd at the time, so there was no problem releasing it. To me, it's just great, you know, a kind of sort of vindication after all those years. Especially after, like, X didn't get its American release as well. So having Star Fox 2 kind of be, cancelled, and also for the kind of reasons that were a bit more, marketing-oriented rather than national mm-hmm. development-oriented,
mm-hmm.
Was kind of frustrating at the time a little bit. But, I was young, so I kind of got over it pretty quickly. But it's still really good, you know, after all those years to actually get the thing out there.
Right.
And, so people can actually play it.
Right.
He's definitely got to tell the story of being drunk with Giles.
Oh, yeah.
You definitely got to do that one.
All right. So what is the story?
It was at the end of Star Fox 2. So at the end of Star Fox 2, we'd gone for a drinks out with the Nintendo guys near the old HQ. And it was like, you know, a whole bunch of people. Then at the end of the night, we thought, oh, let's go and drink some more in downtown Kyoto. And so we got and I didn't have my bicycle with me, and Giles did, and it was like one of those old sort of like mama bikes kind of things. And it had two steps, like two like pegs on the back. And so I got on the back of that, and we were pretty drunk. And I was standing on the pegs and sort of holding his shoulders, and he was like cycling away. And I just found it so hilarious. Like, the situation was just so funny. And he's like working away. And I was just standing like a girlfriend, on the back of this bike. And then I started laughing, and we're going across this, this junction, and all of a sudden, I was just laughing so hard that he kind of twisted the handlebars and we just collapsed to the ground. But in the front of his basket, in front of his bike in the basket, there was like all this like sheaf of like loose leaf paper. And it was like the secret, like, NDA'd, well, not NDA'd back then, but I suppose, like, you know, the secret documents for, you know, the upcoming, what was it codenamed back then? Was it the Ultra? The Ultra 64. And
or Project Reality.
Yeah. It's probably Project Reality at that point, actually. And the sheets of paper just went like all over the junction, like just all over the ground. And the lights turned red for pedestrians, for us, on the bike. And the cars were just coming up and just trying to, you know, just waiting for us to pick up all this paper. And I couldn't stop laughing. And I ended up just cr- cracking, doubling over and just like laughing my head off at the side of the street, just watching, because it was just, it was like from an old like black and white, you know, like comedy movie kind of thing. And he's just running around like trying to get, and like the wind is blowing the paper everywhere, you know, the sheets, and he's running around trying to collect all this stuff up and like getting it to go. And all the cars are like honking their horns and stuff. And I was just laughing at the side of the street. But it was a pretty, weird moment where he could have just, you know, accidentally leaked all the...
specs.
All the specs, and yeah. It was pretty early on. I mean, that was like 95? So pretty early information.
I think we should probably wrap this up now since it's getting kind of late and I don't want to keep you too long. I was hoping to, you know, build into like a history of Q games, but that didn't actually happen. So
we didn't get that far.
Yeah.
Next year.
Yeah, I'll have to come back and grill you on the second half of this podcast.
All the Sony stories.
And Blasto.
There's a lot of Blasto stories.
See, yeah, this is the content that people come for.
So. That's like 3 hours right there.
All right, so that'll be the next three episodes.
Yes.
But yeah, anyway, thanks. This has been really fascinating. I love hearing all this history, especially the sort of nitty-gritty behind-the-scenes stuff on Game Boy. It's just really sort of fascinating to get these insights because it's not something people really talk about and you don't really hear a lot about. For whatever reason. So yeah. I appreciate you taking the time to share these memories and experiences.
Always fun remembering all that stuff.
Yeah. How involved were you with the Game Boy beyond, you know, working on X? Because you worked at Nintendo's offices a lot, right?
Yeah. So
with the R&D1 team.
Yeah, but it was only really on X, and I was very friendly with it. At the time, I think it was like the Metroid team.
Mm.
Metroid 2.
Right, yeah, that was 91, I want to say.
Yeah, yeah. So just as I was making X. Mm. And also they had Super Metroid being developed as well. Very early stages, though. I think it took a lot longer to come
out. Yeah, I think that was like an 18-month project, which was long crazy long back then, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, so I saw that in its very early stages as well, and they were doing the first test with like scrolling sort of backgrounds and tilting the backgrounds and stuff like that. And so it was just a very small team, so I just got very friendly with them all, you know. And back then it was like Hip Tanaka was like the sound guy, and now he runs Creatures, of course, up in Tokyo. So it's just a really good environment, you know, nice and tight. Yokoi-san was really friendly, and it gave me like a candy budget and stuff, so every day I could go and buy... He saw how much candy I was buying every day because it was always really interesting. All this weird stuff, right?
Sure, sure.
And so I'd just buy different stuff every day. And he saw that and he goes, "Oh, I'll give you a budget for that. You can buy whatever you want every day and enjoy yourself." Huh. He was that kind of guy,
right? How hands on was he with the Game Boy like development process? I hear different things. Like some people think that he personally like made every game that has his name on it, whereas other people are like, well, no, he was more like an ideas guy who would just kind of, you know, advise.
It was interesting. It depended on the game. Mm-hmm. But he would play the games extensively.
Okay.
So I have a lot of memories of him just sitting back. Because it was a very open plan office. He didn't have like a closed office or anything. So he was like with everybody else. And he'd just be sitting back and he'd be playing. I think at the time it was Yoshi's. What was the first Yoshi's like game? Not Yoshi's Cookie?
Just Yoshi?
No, the puzzle game.
I think it was just Yoshi. Yoshi's Egg in Japan, maybe?
Maybe that was it. Yeah. And he was very hands on with the design of that. And he was just sitting there playing the game and just think, you know, you could see he was just thinking up like what to do with it and like how to design it or whatever. So for some games, I think he was very, very hands-on, and I think he just really enjoyed it. He was very much a toy maker, so he just loved doing that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I feel like that element that he brought to Nintendo is still there. I mean, you look at Labo, and that is such a, like, you know, the progeny of Mr. Yokoi right there.
Yeah, yeah. I think I remember looking at that and I thought, surely Koto, you know, like Yokoi's, you know, his company that he left, I'm sure that must have, I'm sure that company must have been involved in it, but they weren't. I don't think they were. And but it really felt like it was a Yokoi, Yokoi's DNA kind of in that product.
Yeah, I just feel like, you know, the philosophy that he brought just became such a part of the company. It's still there, you know.
Yes.
20 years after he's gone. So
maybe if anything, like sort of like the Miyamoto side doesn't really have that side of things. They don't really make the toys as much. Mm-hmm. It was always Yokoi's group and the other groups that made like the kind of the more sort of physical interesting stuff.
Right. Yeah. The stuff like the Game Boy camera,
Super Scope.
Yeah, the Super Scope, the Zapper, Rob.
Yeah,
all those things.
And EAD was always the software
kind
of department.
Yeah,
and only software.
Right. You know? Yeah,
And they don't make. They've never really been into the other side of things, like the hardware side.
But yeah, it was great. You know, I think that division of talent worked really well.
Oh yeah, definitely. Yeah.
It's you know, the more I study and research and explore Nintendo's past and the hardware they made and some of the peripherals, like it's always fascinating because it's always almost always like you can kind of see where they said we have, you know, like this much money and we have, you know, just a tiny amount of money and we have this, you know, old technology or this kind of oddball technology that no one else is really using. What can we do with this? How can we make this fun?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that sort of tinkering mentality is really good, I think.
Yeah,
they've always. I think that's why a lot of people underestimate Nintendo sometimes when they think of them as just as like a games, like a game console company. They're much more like a toy company. The way they think, much more about the novelty. You know.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, we should wrap this up now. So, thanks again for your time, Dylan.
Yeah, sure.
And
yeah.
Mark also.
Yeah. Didn't get say much, but
yeah. Sorry, we kind of. Crowded you out.
For Dylan, should have thrown in some questions you have.
Do you guys want to give a quick shout out to your current projects and where people can find you online?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I'm Dylan Cuthbert on Twitter, so DylanCuthbert. Right now we're going to be showing Sticky Bodies, and we also have Monsters, Pixel Junk Monsters 2 coming out May 25th on Switch and PS4 and Steam. And right now, I think that's... Oh, and also we have Eden Obscura, of course, which is launching very soon.
We can announce it here.
That's true. Well, yeah, because it's coming out later. But that's already out, I suppose, because it'll be launched May 18th, next week.
And I'm...
On mobile.
At the Henry Demos on Twitter, and... I did the sound effects for Pixel Junk Monsters 2 and all the music for Sticky Bodies.
Yes.
Nice.
Nice indeed.
Finally, I am Jeremy Parrish. You can find me on Twitter as GameSpite and at Retronauts.com. Retronauts, you can find on the internet, places like iTunes, Podcast One Network, et cetera, et cetera. And we're Patreon supported if you want to help us survive. Patreon.com/retronauts as usual. So thanks again, Dylan. Thanks, Mark. Yeah. Thanks you for listening. That's you. Yes. The person at home. We'll be back in a week with another episode. So look forward to it.
My new $4.99 sourdough patty melt combo with two types of melty cheeses is the perfect comfort food for the uncomfortable things in life, like guys named Ronald. There's just something about that name. Try my $4.99 sourdough patty melt combo, only at Jack in the Box. Limited time only. Price and participation may vary. Small fries and small drink.
The Mueller Report. I'm Ed Donahue with an AP News Minute. President Trump was asked at the White House if Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia investigation report should be released next week when he will be out of town.
I guess from what I understand, that will be totally up to the Attorney General.
Maine's Susan Collins says she would vote for a congressional resolution disapproving of President Trump's emergency declaration to build a border wall, becoming the first Republican senator to publicly back it. In New York, the wounded supervisor of a police detective killed by friendly fire was among the mourners attending his funeral. Detective Brian Simonson was killed as officers started shooting at a robbery suspect last week. Commissioner James O'Neill was among the speakers today at Simonson's funeral.
It's a tremendous weight to bear, knowing that your choices will directly affect the lives of others. But cops like Brian don't shy away from it. It's the very foundation of who they are and what they do.
The robbery suspect and a man police say acted as his lookout have been charged with murder. I'm Ed Donahue.
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious to buy chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.
Four seasons greetings to you all.